Hi, this is Kelly Chase, and you are listening to History Detective. I have recently published a book, History, Her Story, Our Story, Inspirational Women Who Shaped Our World. So for the current series, I thought I would shine a light on authors around the world who are in the field of writing about history. In today's episode, I'm going to be chatting to debut author Madeleine Cleary, the author of a new fiction book called The Butterfly Women. The Butterfly Women is set in 1863 in the post-gold rush thriving city of Melbourne. It tells the story of women who lived in and around the notorious red light district of Little Lawn. It follows four women whose friendships cross class divides as they try and stay safe from a serial killer who is targeting women who work in the sex industry. It is meticulously researched, and it highlights the struggles and ingenuity of women who are trying to survive and thrive in this time that is, quite frankly, unforgiving to women.
Down through the rabbit hole, mystery is so, curiosity to follow.
Welcome to the podcast, Madeleine.
Oh, thanks so much for having me here. I'm really excited to chat.
First of all, I have a bit of a funny story for you.
Oh.
The week before I read your book, I'd been messaging with my mum, and she grew up in Melbourne, and she sent me a few photos of her standing outside her childhood home. It's on the corner of George Street in Melbourne, and I looked it up on Google Maps. Anyway, lo and behold, I open up your book, and the first thing I saw was a map of Melbourne right where she used to live.
Wow, that's amazing. It's like it's meant to be.
Anyway, I have a map-related question. I love a map in the beginning of a book. What's the process of getting a historical map included? How do you ensure historical accuracy? And how much input did you have in the making of this map?
That's a great question, Kelly. I love that. It's something I haven't actually been asked that on an interview as well. I'm a massive map nerd. I actually have in my house this massive print. It's like a beautiful map that's massive, and I've got it all framed of Melbourne in 1864. So you can really zoom in and see. And it's an image that was from the State Library that this company, because it's all now out of copyright, have taken and really cleared up. So you can zoom right in. And that was super helpful for me, because in The Butterfly Women, the characters are constantly walking through the streets of Melbourne. And I think it's really helpful to have a guide and a map, particularly because a lot of the street names have changed over time. And so I suggested it to my publisher. I'm like, I think we need a map. They were like, oh, well, generally fantasy books have maps and, you know, people kind of get it. And I was like, no, I think we really do. And so I'd been using this map for my research and for when I was writing The Butterfly Women. And so my mum, she's an artist. And so I said to mum, would you draw up a map for me? I can give you the names and the dates and like all the historical accuracies. And she did it. So she drew the map in the book.
Wow.
She was the original designer of it. We then paid a person who's officially a map generator. And so, yeah, it's actually really special. And there were so many parts where I had to confirm and check against different maps to confirm the accuracy of the names. And because they flattened a lot of the hills in Melbourne over time as well. So there might have been hills back then that don't exist today. So you can go and walk the streets, but you're not exactly sure if there was a hill or not. Elizabeth Street's always been very sunken in because a creek used to run down. It used to be a tributary to the Yarra River. So we still have that today. But for example, like Batman Hill, which is now Docklands, that was completely destroyed. And then Flagstaff Gardens, where Flagstaff, there used to be a hill there as well. So that again was kind of rolled out. Yeah, massive map nerd.
That's really cool. I love that it has a really good story and that you pushed for it as well. And that your mum had something to do with it. That's so special.
I know. And she said to me, she's like, I'm never doing that again for you, Madeleine. For hours and hours of very painstaking drawing all the little houses out.
Now, your book is set in the red light district of Melbourne in the 1860s, which is just after the peak gold rush, when the gold discoveries were starting to wane in Australia. As I do, I looked up the census data from the Victorian colony in 1861, and the statistics were 302,000 men compared to 211,000 women. There would have been quite a lot of opportunity for women taking on sex work at this time, especially when opportunities were few and far between for actual well-paying jobs.
I love that you went to the census data as well to pick that up, because what you see when you compare the census data from, say, the 1850s, just before gold was found in Victoria, is this huge exponential growth in the population. So you've got this booming population in Melbourne compounded with the arrival of so many, and not just men, but single men, arriving in the colony as well, or men without families. They haven't brought their families with them. They're going off to the gold fields on their own. They're going to send money back to their families. They might eventually bring their families over, but it's, you know, a pretty rough place to be. You've got this excellent opportunity. And it's also like prostitution wasn't illegal at that time as well. And so there was a general, not acceptance, but more of a tolerance that this is going to happen. And so there was this great opportunity for women to run their own businesses, to be entrepreneurial, to make a bit of money. Because like you said, the options to make money were pretty limited, particularly for married women as well with kids.
Funnily enough, the census data there, it also had 24,000 Chinese men and 8 Chinese women.
I know, that astounded me as well. I did look into this because I wondered whether there would have been many Chinese women in Little Lawn and whether that's something I should reflect. And Little Lawn, for those who don't know, is this area in the northeast of Melbourne. It's always been known as a slum in Melbourne. It no longer exists, but historians have been discovering over the last few decades that it's a very complex community. What I learned was that a lot of the Chinese men of that time, when they came to Australia, they came from a very particular province, so Guangdong, which is South China, and a place where I actually lived for a couple of years, along the Pearl River Delta from Hong Kong. They more than often arrived in robe in South Australia, because otherwise they would have to have paid the tax that the British colony decided to tax upon only Chinese men. And it was a cultural thing that they wouldn't bring their wives and they wouldn't bring their children, but they would send money back home. And so they had this very industrious work ethic. Often they would return as well. They would return to China. They would have made their money. But a lot of Chinese also decided to stay. And where they congregated was Little Bourke Street, which now today is Chinatown.
I also wondered when I looked at that data, I thought, who are those 8 women? Do they know each other?
I did research one. She sounded like amazing. I think she was in the theatre, or she was an actress, or she was a singer. So they were very far, few in between. But I think that changed later on in the coming decades when the Chinese men who decided to stay would bring their wives.
When you mentioned that the Chinese men entered in South Australia, they walked to the gold fields, didn't they?
Yes. So I just think this is incredible that they arrived in robe. You know, think about this is like late 1850s, early 1860s, not well-established roads. They're walking hundreds of miles across unknown territory and land. And they did. They reached the gold fields. There's this, I think there's a myth that the words fair dinkum in Australian language comes from a Cantonese saying, in English means big gold mountain. So they would say dim guy sun, and then the Australians interpret that as fair dinkum. And that's where the origin of the etymology of that phrase came from.
And you have a Chinese character in your book, don't you?
Yeah, Lin Chen. Yeah, so Lin Chen was inspired by these incredible men who did come to Australia, and he is one of the ones that stayed. And a lot of the Chinese men who did stay would set up, particularly in Little Lawn, fruit and vegetable groceries. Yeah, they were part of the fabric of what makes Melbourne today. Chinatown at the time, Little Bourke Street in particular, was a pretty difficult place to live. There was a lot of poverty. And of course, there's a lot of talk about opium dens. And I think though, they've contributed so much to our society. And it was a great thing to be able to do. I just arrived back from China after spending 2 years there. And so it was a nice way to sort of reflect my love and interest in the country.
I often teach my students about the goldfields, and there's quite a few rich sources from women, of women's voices. And one of them is the diary of a woman who worked in the goldfields. She's using her husband's license to dig for gold while he's off drinking. And then he ends up gambling away all of the fortune that she earned. Her story very much reminded me of Catherine with her no-hope husband and his chronic gambling addiction. In your research, what sources or stories did you read to help you build this rich world of 1860s Melbourne and showcase the voices of women?
Yeah, when you were talking about women on the goldfields, it reminds me of The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka, Claire Wright's, which is just a brilliant, brilliant book. Oh, and I love that historians are finding all these interesting stories out. Women who ran businesses and shops. I think there's a diary of a woman who came to the goldfields and ran a business there and a shop. And she's like a well-to-do kind of lady, and there she is. You know, it's just awesome to see that. In terms of the butterfly women, so I was really, really fortunate in meeting with Barbara Minchinton, who's a historian. She's written two books about that era now, The Women of Little Lon, which came out in 2022 with Black Ink, and more recently, Madame Brussels. And when I started writing The Butterfly Women, it was back in 2019, and I didn't have a lot of primary sources. There are no diaries from the women who worked in the brothels. A lot of the women were illiterate. There were some that were literate, of course, but we don't have any of those sources. What I was using were newspaper articles from the day, because a lot of these women were often arrested and charged with all sorts of crimes, not for prostitution, but for things like disorderliness and vagrancy and drunkenness. And so I used some of the language. Newspapers were so interesting in the 19th century. They record all sorts of fun and interesting details. We actually found, and this is why I wrote the book, was because my great-great-great-grandmother, Catherine Cleary, was one of them. And so we found about 200 newspaper articles about just our family. And so I was able to use some of that to incorporate, you know, get a sense of what their lives were and what their circumstances were. My family were, they were quite notorious. They were living in hovels and working in Bilking Square and the back slums. Whereas in the novel, in The Butterfly Women, I set the novel around a high-class brothel, very much inspired by Madame Brussels' establishment on Lonsdale Street. And so I drew very heavily on Barbara Minchinton's work. And she worked in the archaeological digs in the 80s and 90s and 2000s. And she has drawn from her research as a historian working on these digs insights into the women's lives, which in 2022, when it came out, fundamentally changed the book for me. I was able to really hear the voices very clearly. I've been very lucky in that I contacted Barbara straight away. We've had a long email trail going back and forth for 3 years. She read an early draft, so she was able to endorse it. And she came to the book launch in Melbourne a few months ago. So I've been really fortunate to have a historian closely associated with this project.
There's another story of a woman who came to Victoria on a separate boat to join her husband on the goldfields. And when she arrived in Victoria, he hadn't arrived yet. So she ended up dressing in men's clothes to protect herself. I bring this up because in your novel, you have two female characters dress in men's clothing. Can you tell me about the real life historical inspiration for one of my favorite characters, Constable Mary?
Constable Mary, yes, you're right. She dresses up in her husband's clothes to police his beat. And that's part of the murder mystery narrative of The Butterfly Women. It was probably back in 2017. I was reading Robin Anear's incredible book, Bear Brass, which is another amazing historical account of early Melbourne. And she references Gary Owen. Gary Owen was an early chronicler of Melbourne. He's written these very delightful accounts of his walks through Melbourne in the 1840s, very early. And he mentioned that he saw a short, stout immigrant woman, a stump of an immigrant woman. I love the description, but very clever, who would follow her husband around. And her husband was a sergeant. And when he ultimately fell over drunk, she would take him home, drag him home, dress in his uniform, and then go do his rounds for him, which I just loved. I read that line and I just said, oh, this has to be a character. She did get caught, I think, the real life Constable Mary, and she got charged with impersonating a police officer. But in The Butterfly Women, I have her as an accepted part of the community.
Now, there was a part in the book that I got shivers and I teared up, and it was right at the end of the acknowledgements when you talk about your ancestor, Catherine Cleary. She was described as obstinate and eccentric and declared she would sooner cut out her own throat than give evidence against her neighbour. I'd love that. We don't often get to hear the voices of the working class women from the past, let alone ones that were related to you. You mentioned before that there were more than 200 articles in the paper about your family, which is quite extraordinary. I've looked mine up. I can't find anything. We were quite vanilla. So how was that discovery for you, discovering the voice of these women in the paper?
Yeah, it was amazing. And it started in 2014 when Dad was contacted on Ancestry.com by a woman who said, "Did you know that you're related to this infamous Cleary family? Very notorious in the 19th century in Melbourne for decades, really." And we had no idea. Dad had done us some preliminary research, but we couldn't really find anything past his grandfather. So we didn't really know what our roots were. I remember when Dad told me, I was probably in my mid-20s then, and I remember thinking, oh, notorious crime family. I thought of the men immediately. You're like, oh, they must have been in jail for like violence, assault, you know, possibly a murder maybe. And they were in jail for like lots of different things. But it was the women's stories that really captured my interest. They probably featured a lot more than the men too. So my great-great-great-grandmother Catherine arrived with her husband into Sydney in 1838. And then we have the first recording of them in Melbourne in around 1852, pretty much soon after gold had been discovered, a couple of years after. And from about 1855, we have them positioned in that Little Lawn area where it's recorded that they're living at the back of the Black Eagle Hotel, which is a building that still exists today in one of, and this is the newspapers, how they described it, one of the most disgusting dens in all of Melbourne. And apparently there's a constable who, in one of the newspaper articles, he stated that when he walked in, there was a soldier half drunk, lying prone on the floor. The room was in a state of disarray. Women were drunk and falling over each other. And he just arrested everyone. Alcohol was, it was a vice and it was very present. I think back in the 19th century, we have to understand that they didn't have pain medication the way that we do today. And so alcohol was a way to escape whatever reality, whatever pain they're living in. And they were living in pretty squalid circumstances. For example, my great-great-aunt, Joanna. Joanna is in the book, in The Butterfly Women. She's an Irish poor servant. Her ending is very different to my actual great-great-aunt. She died at the age of 35 in jail. And she was described as a diseased, miserable creature. For me, and I guess this is for any kind of research, you always start with a question. And for me, it was wanting to better understand what the lives were of my ancestors, what drew them to this area, what were their circumstances, why did they turn to sex work? And that's been the whole genesis of this book.
In the newspapers, did you hear the words within the court transcripts of your ancestors?
Yeah, for sure. And there's one really, really good one where Catherine is having a bit of a repartee with the magistrate. And you can just start to see her personality shine through. Like you mentioned before about how she said she would rather cut her own throat than say a word to injure the prisoner, her neighbour. And she's been described as one of the most evil, wretched women in Little Lawn in the papers. And here she is defending her neighbour. There were other things where she's on trial and the magistrate saying, "What were you doing last night?" "I don't know. Don't know where I was. Don't know who I am. Don't know where I work. I change that every day." He said, "Oh, do you know this man?" She goes, "I don't have time to speak to men. I'm so busy with all my children." And so I used some of those lines in The Butterfly Women. I literally laughed out loud when I read these. It really contrasted with the descriptions of her as this evil, awful person.
That's good journalism, isn't it? Having her witty remarks in there.
Yes. Yes, it was fantastic. And that's what the 19th century newspapers did. They just loved to transcribe all of this great detail. I'm not a historian, but I'm an avid researcher. Seeing that it written is fantastic.
I also want to ask about one of your characters was born in the female factory in Tasmania. What inspired that choice?
So we actually went to the female factory probably in 2021, I think. And when I was at the female factory, I just got such a – have you been to it?
Yes, I have. That's why I asked.
Yeah, it's such an incredible place. And I mean, there's not much left of the actual building, but the tour and the stories are still so present. And I think the ghosts of that place are still so present. I really wanted to reflect that. And, you know, the women who came and were put into that factory, who were on that rotational basis going in and out, depending on how well they behaved, who had to give birth and put their children and their babies into care, essentially, into this awful squalid conditions. Like, it's a heavy history and something that I think we need to acknowledge.
Now, although your book has several characters who are sex workers, you've not included gratuitous sex scenes, which I really appreciate because, you know, I prefer to spend time in the atmosphere and the plot rather than in the bedrooms. How did you come to make this stylistic choice?
Well, I knew my mother would read it.
Fair enough.
No. A lot of people have asked me, who don't know much about the book, they say, oh, there must be a lot of sex in it. This is not a book about sex because it's actually a book about women's agency and flipping what we know about history. I mean, there are a few allusions to it. It's not graphic because, of course, sex is part of it. But it's also a book about female friendship and camaraderie, and it's also about conversation and company and loneliness and all sorts, because sex workers didn't just offer up sex. They offered all sorts of different services to men at the time. So it was definitely deliberate. If I thought that it was necessary to, as part of a storytelling perspective, I would have included it. But I wanted to include more about the friendship side and the relationships.
Now, there was a really short passage in the book where you talk about the methods of contraception for women at the time, which makes sense when you're writing about women working in a brothel. And one of them made me shudder, which was a mercury douche. What are some of the measures that these women took to avoid pregnancy?
Yeah, it was pretty heavy reading, actually. Contraception, it's just something we take for granted in, you know, our times. But back then there was things called the widow's Welch's pills, which they would take. These were carcinogenic and often would lead to, and particularly like the mercury douches, would lead to a lower life expectancy because you're essentially ingesting poison into your body. I mean, obviously there were pregnancies. Abortions happened quite regularly. If you worked at a good house, you might have access to a proper medical professional for that abortion. But if you're on the streets like my family, you would probably go to a wise woman or a local quack. The risk to women's health was significant and a lot of women would have died. There's this great anecdote about Madame Brussels. They found in her effects a coin. They said that back in the day, women who were sex workers would carry a coin that had been fashioned in a V format.
Oh, like an IUD.
Like an IUD, and that they would insert that and use that as contraception.
Huh.
This was like the rumor. And then in Madame Brussels' effects, when she died, in her purse, they found a coin. They say it's like a special thing for a woman. It's like her special personal effects. So that could also have been something that they used as a barrier. It's crazy, though, the things you research for a book, like contraception methods in 19th century Melbourne.
A few of the characters tipple a little bit in absinthe at one point, and someone smoking an opium pipe. You've talked about before that you've become friends with a historian who did some archaeology in Little Lawn area that helped inform some of the information you included. How do you go about researching the drug and alcohol usage in a red light district from 160 years ago?
Actually, that was the easy part, because when they were doing the digs in that Little Lawn area, they uncovered all the alcohol bottles that people had thrown into the cesspit. And a cesspit, for those who don't know, is a big hole in the ground where people defecated. That's the polite word. And whether you were rich or poor, that was your method. I spent a lot of time researching toilet usage in the 1860s, like a lot of time. So what they uncovered in the cesspits were, and this is what really interested the historians, because they thought it was a slum. So they expected, you know, cheap alcohol, but what they found was like French champagne bottles, the finest quality, expensive French champagne. They found absinthe bottles, which the everyday layperson, a poor Irish immigrant, is not going to be drinking fine French champagne. And people would literally just throw them into their cesspits. So we've got this rich plethora of different types of bottles that, yeah, I was able to include. They're now on display at the Melbourne Museum, so you can see them. And also in the building that exists now in Castledon Place, that you can go and have a look at the French champagne and the absinthe.
What about the opium use? How do you research that?
Yeah, I mean, opium, it was common knowledge that opium was used in that particular era, particularly around Little Bourke Street. It was quite common. There's actually images that you can look online of some of these opium dens where people would lie in straight forms. They almost like look like cots, double story cots, and people would lie in them and they would have the opium pipe between them and they would share that. These images, they're quite startling actually to see and quite graphic. Opium was also used as a pain medication as well. Highly addictive though, but it was, yeah, super common use in Melbourne at the time.
So you just said you did a lot of toilet research. What did you find out? What did they wipe with?
Actually, I don't know what they used to wipe with, I'm sure. Yeah, I mean, they wouldn't have had toilet paper. I didn't go that far, but I did. One of my characters, she does go to the toilet in the novel, because I always like having novels where they go to the toilet because it's not something you really think about. And so, yeah, I did all this research because I'm like, well, maybe they would have used a bedpan if she was in a nice house. No, bedpans were not a thing at the time. In 1860s Melbourne, you would have gone out to the cesspit. Cesspits, generally, if you're in a good house, you'd have your own. It was in the backyard. If you were living in Little Lawn, you would have maybe a cesspit shared amongst a few hovels and houses. But the problem is when it rained, and everyone knows how much it rains in Melbourne, it would flood. And so all the things inside there would then stream down the seat because there was no sewerage. There wasn't any sewerage, proper sewerage in Melbourne until like the late 1880s. And literally the sewerage would just go down the gutters. Apparently it was like toxic green slime. It looked foul and it smelt even worse.
I imagine that lack of sanitation comes from the fact that there was such an influx of people in such a short time and they weren't able to keep up with the infrastructure.
Yeah, they didn't have any infrastructure. And so, of course, you can imagine then that disease spread very quickly. They actually had no official source of water, like clean, fresh source of water, until 1858, I believe. And that's when they turned on the Yan Yean Reservoir. So then they piped that water into Melbourne in 1858. So that's quite late to have a fresh water supply. Before that, they would go down to the Yarra. And unfortunately, by that time, they were cleaning, washing. Industry was there. So they had all these awful meat works and tanning factories and leather works. And so all that offal and waste is all going into the river and they're washing and bathing and drinking it. People were dying. Children were dying of dysentery and all sorts of terrible typhus and terrible illnesses. And so when the Yan Yean Reservoir turned on and the water started getting piped, the disease was cut very significantly. They were still living in pretty squalid conditions, but the water helped. Clean water helped.
Well, you hear this historical narrative of marvellous Melbourne during the gold rush and all these things being built, but in actuality, it was probably a bit more manky Melbourne.
It was. It was a city, and this is why I chose the 1860s, because it's kind of a city that's halfway there. And I think that kind of marvellous Melbourne happened in the 1880s, and that's when you had the boom era. You had all these beautiful buildings being built. But in the 1860s, some of that stuff was starting along Collins Street, but a lot of houses were still made of timber. They had some institutions popping up. They had the Melbourne Jail, they had the State Library, like parts of those things, but it was in flux. And I love that. I love that it's in flux.
Now, because I'm thorough, I like to read a book and I also like to listen to the audio. When I started the audio, you have one of my favorite voice actors reading your book. How involved are you in the audiobook process? Do you have to adapt any parts of your novel for that?
I didn't actually, but I was given some audio auditions from a few different actors. And so as soon as I heard Joe's adaptation of The Butterfly Women, I knew she was perfect for the role. And her voice is familiar. For those who don't know, Jo Vanness is the narrator of Gogglebox. And so her voice is very familiar. I haven't listened to the audiobook, to be honest, because I think as the author, listening back to your own words, that's kind of painful. And I do think she does the accents really well. I've listened to a little bit about it. And there's lots of different accents. It's quite complex. I did have a really good chat with Wave Sound, who produced it, about whether we need to have different voice actors for all the different perspectives. But we decided, because it's in the third person, that we would have one who can do all the multiple different characters. And I think that worked out really well. But yeah, Jo's just done such a great job and I'm thrilled with the outcome. But I didn't really have much to do with the actual production of it.
No, she really has done a wonderful job. So you can rest assured.
Right.
You don't have to listen to it and cringe. Now, I know that you're on a social media ban at the moment.
You've done your research.
I know. I'm also trying to cut back on, and I have removed apps from my phone. I've got a bedside clock now. The phone's not allowed in the bedroom. What difference has this made to your life?
So much. I mean, it's only been 3 weeks. It's really nice though, because I've got a very supportive husband who's checking it for me just in case anything pops up that I need to address. And there have been a few things, but I would highly recommend it. I was finding I was spending a lot of time on my phone, particularly in the early days when The Butterfly Women was released, because it was only released, you know, a few months ago. And that's important. I think it's part of the business as an author. You have to be responsive and it's fun to engage with readers. But I found after maybe 2 months of that I needed a break. And I'm also writing book two. And so it's nice to be able to put my creativity into writing rather than into curating social media posts. So my phone time's cut by half now. I have a block. It's an app called Freedom, which I have on my phone. Instagram is kind of blocked out. So if I try and get it, I can't get it onto it. And my husband has the two-factor authentication for my account and it goes to his mobile phone. So even if I try to log in, I can't. He would get the text message saying, I'm trying to log in. So it's fully accountable. I would recommend it.
I feel like it makes you so much more creative and productive with your time, because it's so easy to just lose time.
I love the engagement with the readers. That's the best part. But you find you're scrolling through things and before you know it, half an hour's gone. And that's crucial time. I also work part-time. Like I work 4 days a week. I have a day job and I'm still writing. And so my time's really, really important. And my writing time I have to really protect, I think.
Now, you mentioned book two, and I think you announced that on your podcast yesterday. Is it a follow-on from this book or is it a different story? Is it connected in any way?
So different characters, but it's set about 15 years later from The Butterfly Women. So it's the late 1870s in Melbourne. It's just before the boom time. So things have changed quite a bit in Melbourne, and it's based around a bookstore in Russell Street, spiritualist bookstore. There will be some crossovers, but it's definitely not a sequel. It's more of a companion novel.
Oh, how wonderful. I look forward to that. Clearly, people who are listening are already podcast listeners and you have your own podcast. Can you let listeners know how they can find your podcast, find your book, find your work, find everything about you?
Of course, of course. So yes, I am a co-host on the Book Deal podcast. Our podcast is all about inspiring and motivating emerging writers, but also early career writers. It's really for any writer who's interested and just wants that motivation. We particularly do author interviews about pathways to publication. Everyone has a different journey to publication, and we like to get behind the book deal and find out all the interesting things behind it. So we love it. It's almost our 1 year anniversary actually in July. We've got a great listening group and it's been really good. And then, yeah, if people want to reach out to me, obviously I'm off Instagram, but my husband's monitoring it. So feel free to reach out. Alternatively, my website, so madelinecleary.com.au, there's a contact form there. So yeah, if you want to continue the conversation, I also have a Substack newsletter, so you can sign up through my website on there too.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today and chatting all things research.
Thanks so much, Kelly. This has been so fun. Like, this is like my favorite thing, is to talk about the research. So I really appreciate it.
Just whose truth will it be? Hers or his story? Maybe just a little bit in between.